To mark Earth Day, leaders and diplomats from more than 150 countries converged on the United Nations in New York to sign the Paris Climate Agreement at the opening of the year-long window for its adoption. Back in 2014, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and China's State Councilor Yang Jiechi struck a deal to work together to make deep emissions cuts, a deal that became the main architecture of the Paris Agreement. Still, bringing in more than 180 other nations and getting the strong commitment of business leaders for the Paris negotiations wasn't easy. Many credit the skillful, tireless diplomacy from UN Climate Conference and French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius and the brilliant leadership from the Executive Secretary of the UN Climate Conference, Christiana Figueres, who was welcomed like this. At the party that some delegates, environmental and civil society activists, held the night the agreement was sealed. The Living on Earth team was there. We whipped out our cell phones to record the euphoric response. And Christiana Figueres joins me again now. Welcome.
Well, thanks very much, Steve.
You know, the last time I saw you, you were practically crowd surfing in this wild celebratory party in Paris. How does it feel to be a rock star?
You know, honestly, that last night was such a crazy night. It was a fantastic celebration with so many people from so many different sectors, from so many different countries, all of whom were truly ecstatic. And ecstatic, I think, because so many people worked for so many years to get to a global agreement. And we did. And the result was, in fact, even more ambitious than most people thought was going to be possible. So yeah, it was a very celebratory night.
How do you feel about the Paris Agreement now?
A couple of thoughts. Yes, I would agree with the celebration mood that night. It was historic. It was unprecedented and truly the result of a lot of hard work from thousands and thousands, if not millions of people, honestly. I also am quite happy about some of the very technical results that allow us to now guide the transformation of the global economy toward a decarbonized society over time. So that's the good news. The bad news, honestly, is that I feel that that agreement, you know, if we lived in a perfect world, is actually coming too late. You know, in a perfect world, we should have come to that kind of an agreement perhaps 10 years ago. And I know, you know, that it was not possible 10 years ago. We know that we weren't ready. But just from a science point of view, just from an intense vulnerability of populations point of view, we're really, you know, running against the limit here. So what it has done is put a lot of pressure now on the implementation of that agreement. And again, in a perfect ideal world, we would have a little bit more time to implement, but now we're 5 minutes to 12. So the speed and scale of implementation is going to have to be pretty aggressive.
When you say 5 minutes to 12, what are you thinking of in scientific terms?
What I'm thinking of is something that is not in the Paris Agreement, which is when do we actually have to get to the maximum point of emissions, which is called peaking, and begin to descend. We should be peaking within this decade. We should be peaking by 2020 for one purpose, which is to protect the most vulnerable populations. Because peaking after that is going to mean that we accumulate greenhouse gas concentrations that make it very, very difficult for the survival or even adaptation of the most vulnerable populations. Now, most vulnerable populations are in developing countries. The irony of this whole exercise is that developing countries themselves will have to make an effort for their own security. And that is a tough pill to swallow, right? Because developing countries do not have the historical responsibility. They're moving into a position of responsibility into the future, but they do not have the historical responsibility. And yet, if developing countries do not act, they are working against their own interest.
Let's talk about some of the numbers in Paris. The goal, I believe, is to keep things below 2.0 degrees centigrade rise.
Well below, and make every effort to keep it under 1.5.
How important is that?
It's critical. It is truly, truly critical. And it is most critical for the most vulnerable populations. Again, you know, the guiding star here is how are we going to protect the most vulnerable? Because these are countries and populations that are exempted of emission responsibility. That does not mean that they're exempted of action responsibilities, two different types of responsibilities. And, you know, one of the very rays of light and hope of the Paris Agreement is that every country agreed that they want to contribute, even if it's in a small way. However, we cannot lose sight of the fact that vulnerability and impact truly is exacerbated upon some populations. And if we do not get to 1.5, if we go, first of all, if we go above 2, Steve, I have to share with you, the insurance industry has already determined that a world that goes above 2 degrees is uninsurable. You and I do not want to live in a world that is uninsurable, and certainly corporate world does not want to operate in a world that is uninsurable. So that's already, you know, one sort of economic threshold. Now, the human threshold is the 1.5, because what the 1.5 does, it doesn't even guarantee the survival of the most vulnerable. It gives them a fighting chance.
One problem, the independently determined national commitments, these INDCs, they...
I'm going to finish your sentence for you, okay? They do not add up to 1.5 or 2 degrees.
Yeah, it's a very toasty 2.5 or more.
2.7 to 3 is what they have. So, you know, what's the good news there? The good news of the INDCs is that in a world without those climate change plans, we were headed for a world that would have increased 4 to 5 and by some accounts, even 6 degrees. Frankly, completely unviable world.
Okay. Well, does it matter? I mean, because if the world is uninsurable at 2 degrees, if it's really even, you know, it's a challenge for folks to survive at 1.5, once you get to 3 or 4 or 5.
Then what it means is it's a very unfair selection, right? Because it is those that have the most resources to be able to afford the adaptation to those conditions that would be the ones who would have a chance. And the others who don't have those resources would have no chance. That's not the world that we want to live in, right? So the good news of the INDCs is that we have at least shaved off the worst scenario, the worst consequences. So that's better, but it's not where we want to be. And because we knew this ahead of time, and I had warned the press at least a year ahead, and I had actually told them, if any of you come, you know, and all of a sudden have a eureka moment in Paris and say, oh, discovery, the INDCs do not get us to well below 2 degrees or 1.5, I'm going to chop your head off, because I'm telling you now, a year before Paris, that they do not get us there. And that is why the Paris Agreement has a very, very different logic to the Kyoto Protocol. The Kyoto Protocol is a static commitment that by X year, you will have reduced X amount. The Paris Agreement does not have that deadline. What the Paris Agreement does is it establishes a process throughout which countries will increase their emission reductions and certainly their resilience. So my guess is we're probably going to go through a 10, 15, maybe a 20-year process of constant improvement, constant increase in efforts to reduce emissions until we get to where we need to get to.
So if we were to do a little bit of math, humanity is emitting someplace between 8 to 10 gigatons of carbon
a year. 32 per year?
32 gigatons of carbon a year? Oh my, so...
I think I'm picking up your thoughts here, Steve. So here's the math, okay? We already have 2,000 gigatons up there in the atmosphere, right? If we want to stay under 2 degrees, we only have a sum total of another 1,000 gigatons that we can put up there. That's not for this year or for this decade or for the century. That is 1,000 gigatons for as long as humans intend to stay on this planet, unless we invent some other, you know, absorption of carbon methodology that we don't have yet. If we want to stay under 1.5, we only have 600 gigatons. So, you know, you do the math.
Let's do the math. So roughly we have 30 years to eliminate these emissions.
Yeah, no, we don't. We don't have 30 years. We have much less than that. Because if we are to take those 30 years, then you are assuming that we're going to go with 32 every year, and then we're going to go from 32 to zero. Well, that is not realistic. There is no way that the economy, you know, that transportation, that energy, that agriculture can go from 32 on the 31st of December of year, whatever, and by January, we're down to zero. We have to be able to buy ourselves the time for a smooth transition.
At the Paris meeting, some folks from developing countries pointed out one of the big obstacles around finance is the interest rate environment, that when European and American companies go into the capital markets, they borrow at 2, 3, 4%, whereas if you're in India or in Cameroon, you're going to pay 12, 15%, and that therefore there's a tremendous advantage that the rich part of the world has over the developing world, and yet the developing world needs lots of capital resources. How do we get around that?
In general, it's true. It's not true of every single developing country, but in general, it is true that developing countries face a higher cost of capital than industrialized countries. Why is that? Because A, there is at least a perception, whether it's true or not, but there's a perception of political risk. There's a perception of policy risk, meaning that some countries put a policy in and then take it out. There's a currency risk. And there is what I call the risk of the unknown, because a lot of capital, you know, we just don't have a long-standing tradition of investing the levels of investment that need to go in now into developing world, right? We're getting there, but it still is a considered very risky business. So from an investor point of view, you can't blame them because they have to give a value to that risk. So the challenge here in bringing down the cost of capital is you need to bring other financial institutions whose bread and butter it is to work in our developing countries, who understand our realities, and who actually have the possibility and the understanding of taking that risk off the table. So here I'm talking, for example, very specifically about developing banks. The Inter-American Bank knows Latin America very well. The African Development Bank knows the African countries very well. They know all our quirks. They've been working there for years. It is their responsibility to actually work here and, you know, to be very specific, to go into the NDCs that all of these countries have put on the table and work with other financial institutions so that the developing banks can be helpful in developing the kind of financial instruments that are necessary to buy down some of the risk and then attract foreign capital investment that can go in there at a cost of capital that is competitive.
Why isn't that happening? We're facing a climate emergency. The people do need to develop in a sustainable, low-carbon way. Not much time, and yet the money doesn't seem to be moving.
I completely agree. You know, I've come to the conclusion that we have moved from, you know, the financial crisis of 2008 to the financial emergency of 2016. And the fact is, you know, that today, 2016, we see capital that has been accumulating since 2008 because there is no place to put the capital. So you have an accumulation of capital here over here, you know, with my left hand, and with my right hand, you have an enormous need for investment, particularly in infrastructure, both for energy generation, for transport, and all of the infrastructure that is necessary for adaptation. And so you have supply and demand, and they're not talking to each other yet. I am feeling a huge urgency around how do we build the bridge? Big question mark.
So you worked really hard on this. 6 years you served as executive secretary, and you're about to leave. What's ahead for you? What do you do to top this?
Well, it is difficult to top, honestly. It's been a true privilege and an honor to support all governments and so much of the private sector that has actually also accompanied us, as well as civil society. It's been just been a fantastic opportunity to have that breadth and depth of collaboration for a true common cause. But what do I do after the 7th of July? Honestly, it's still unknown. There are many balls in the air. There are many muffins in the oven. And I'm still trying to decide which of those muffins do I want to prioritize and pull out of the oven. So stay tuned. We'll see.
They need a new Secretary General at the UN.
Not they, we the population, we the peoples need a new Secretary General at the UN. And I am actually quite happy about the fact that it does seem that there is a huge political push for that to be a woman. And I think it is about time after 70 years of the United Nations and 8 Secretary Generals, it's about time that there be a woman. We also know that it is, if we follow geographic rotation, it is the turn of Eastern Europe. And there are currently quite a few female candidates, some male also, but quite a few female candidates from Eastern Europe and from other regions. So we will wait and see what happens.
To wrap this up, so if you were in charge of all of this, what would you do to get this to respond to the tremendous challenges that the science tells us we have?
You know, I'm very happy, and I think everybody is, about the direction that we're moving in, because we are moving incontrovertibly and unstoppably toward a decarbonized world and a more resilient world. The piece that is not there yet is the sense of urgency. The fact is that we would move toward that decarbonized society and a more resilient infrastructure globally anyway, because that has already started. But what we need to do is increase the speed. So I'm on a personal campaign to invite every person that I meet to swallow an alarm clock and to realize that, you know, this is ticking inside of us. We just cannot rest on our laurels, and we can't. This is not about business as usual. This is, you know, a new definition of BAU. This is business as urgent. So let's swallow the alarm clock, step up to the plate, and increase the speed with which we're taking all of these fantastic decisions, but that are not happening fast enough.
Christiana Figueres is the Executive Secretary of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. Thanks so much for taking this time with us today.
Thank you very much, Steve, for the invitation to be here with you today. I really enjoyed it.